To most all in the environmental advocacy profession, climate change is scientific fact, undeniable, and nearly all scientists agree. And yet, in the public discourse, climate change is often less about fact than it is about political perception. 75% of Democrats in America believe in climate change. 35% of Republicans believe in climate change. If we accept that the nation is about evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, that means just a little over 50% of the country believes climate change is real. There are many questions to consider. Among them, why is the message failing to resonate in so many sectors of society? And are the right messengers putting forth the evidence that might say more swift and decisive action on climate change-related issues is needed? This is 89.1 WEMU, and I'm David Fair. Those are among the questions we'll consider this morning on WEMU's First Friday Focus on the Environment. My co-host for this segment is Lisa Wozniak. Lisa is Executive Director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
And our guest today, Lisa.
Our guest today is Andy Hoffman. Andy holds joint appointments at the Ross School of Business and the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Michigan. And one of Andy's many titles is Director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Andy, you have published 9 books and numerous articles, the majority of which relate to environmental issues and implications for business. Your most recent research, which has gotten significant coverage in major press around the nation, has pivoted slightly and focuses on the debate around climate change as a culture war. What do you mean by that?
Well, the issue of climate change, what we think about it, there is a scientific consensus that anthropogenic climate change is happening. There's a series of questions there we can go into if you'd like about where there is uncertainty in the questions and where there is certainty. But at the present, we lack a social consensus. And it's important to recognize that the processes by which we reach scientific consensus are very different than a social consensus. The players involved, the questions that are asked, the processes that people use in the social debate are very different and often non-technical, highly emotional, highly cultural. And so climate change itself has been caught up in the culture wars. Positions on climate change correlate with positions on health care, abortion, gun control, these kinds of things. And that's a problem when we think about this debate going forward.
There was a time when, at least I accepted science as truth. When in the process did we stop accepting that?
Well, I don't know if I'd put it as black and white as that, as truth or non-truth. When we think about the scientific consensus on climate change, it's really not a single question. It's a series of questions. And very often people ask the question in a convoluted way, is anthropogenic climate change happening? That's a question that actually merges a question of science and a question of judgment. And we need to break out the sciences if we're going to, scientific questions, if we're going to make the debate more informed. So let's go through them. Is CO2 going up? Yes. The scientific models, the measurement data that we have, CO2 is certainly going up. Can CO2 increases change the climate? Again, yes. The science of that process is very clear and understood. Is the climate changing? Again, yes. Measurement data for temperature globally is very clear. The climate is changing. Are we causing it? Now we shift from an issue of science to an issue of judgment. Increases in CO2 correlate with the Industrial Revolution and emissions of man-made sources. That correlation is a pretty clear one. Are humans causing it? In my opinion, yes. In the opinion of most scientists, yes, until there's an alternative hypothesis. That is the one that will stand. Find another reason why CO2 went up with the Industrial Revolution, and you can enter that debate. What are the implications of this? Now we get into the area where science actually starts to ask some questions, and we can draw a bell curve. And on one tail, very low impacts. On the other tail, major impacts. And in between, with various probabilities, different kinds of outcomes. And that's where the discussion is an area where we could have some serious discussion about what you call truth or not truth. It's really about what do scientists know and not know, what can they prove and not prove. And in that domain, then we can have a genuine conversation.
To continue right along that line, later this month, the Nobel Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is going to meet in Uganda, where its latest report will be formally issued. Now, pieces of that report are starting to come out, and it states there is a 2 in 3 possibility climate extremes have already worsened because of those man-made greenhouse gases you mentioned. But this marks a departure in climate science from focusing on the subtle changes in daily average temperatures to concentrating more on the harder-to-analyze freak events that grab the headlines, that cause economic damage, and kill people. So is that kind of in the center of that bell curve you're talking about?
Well, yeah. I mean, you along the horizontal axis in that bell curve, without getting too scientific jargony about this, but you have minor impacts and increasing impacts going forward. But it's very difficult to connect single events to climate change. That's a very hard thing to do because we're talking about aggregate models and we're talking about long-term time changes. So 1 year or one event connecting it to climate change, pretty challenging. But I would like to steer the conversation towards the public acceptance of these notions. And with that, we have to recognize that more data, more models, get people who are disinclined to believe climate change to dig their heels in even harder. We need to get down deeper and understand what are the reasons why people resist the science of climate change. And it does come down to cultural ideology, trust in science, faith in the market, trust in government, political ideology of the proponents of climate change. These are where the debate is really taking place.
Religion plays a role too.
Absolutely. You know, reducing CO2 is not a pollution issue. When we typically think about pollution, it's an unwanted byproduct of an industrial process, and we want to reduce or even eliminate it. But CO2 is part of our life. I'm emitting CO2 right now. The plants are absorbing it. We need to think it's an issue of balance and integrating ourselves within the natural environment. If we move beyond the idea that it's a pollution issue, it's really a cultural issue. And it really does get down to how we live and how we think about the world around us. Climate change is an existential challenge to some deep beliefs we have. Do you believe that we as a species have grown to such numbers and our technology to such power that we can alter the global climate? That is a big question that alters the order of things in our world, the way we individually and collectively conceive it. If you say yes, then that, for some people, displaces their notion of God and divine providence. Are we really in charge of the global climate, or is God? I mean, that really becomes a challenge for some people. And then you can go from there. Do we have a different set of ethical beliefs? Does my mowing my lawn in Ann Arbor have implications for the poor people of Bangladesh? Are we ready to go there? And can we get global cooperation on this issue? That is a challenge that we as a species, a magnitude challenge that we've never seen before. It dwarfs the Montreal Protocol. It dwarfs global trade. To handle CO2 as a global problem with global cooperation, monumental challenge.
So I need to ask this question. I mean, you speak a lot in your research about climate brokers.
Right.
What does that mean? Give me an example of a good climate broker, given that this has become so polarized.
Right. Well, if we think about it as polarized, the people, they take positions on this issue based on the referent group, and it could be Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, or it could be other referent groups as well. You know, the far-right evangelicals are very uncomfortable with green theology. So people in their referent group are trying to figure out how do they make sense out of these complex scientific issues. And we could talk about many issues, nanotechnology, GMOs, all kinds of issues. They're very complex. The science is beyond most people. So how do they make decisions? They look for people that they respect, that have the values that they hold, and listen to what they say and start to make opinions. That's why we purposely steer ourselves towards Fox News or NPR. There's an ideological split there. And so if you want to get people to hear the message, the messengers have to be people that they trust. So if you're trying to reach conservative Republicans, Al Gore is not the messenger. They're not going to listen to him. But are there people on that they respect? And so the military, religious leaders, Republican politicians. These are the kinds of brokers, these are the kind of people that those people that conservative Republicans will listen to. And if they can start to push the message, then you got something.
So you told the New York Times recently that people have more trust in economic institutions and scientific institutions. What institutions are already acting
right
as those climate brokers?
Right. Well, the military is. They're looking at renewables in a very serious way for very practical reasons. I mean, the delivered cost of gasoline to remote battlefield operations is astronomical. And if they could get power from the sun to power those stations, it would be really great. The Vatican, is out there saying, okay, wait a minute, I mean, climate change affects the poor people first. Maybe we need to attend to this. And business leaders. In our society, people have more faith in business institutions than political or economic or scientific ones.
So if it becomes profitable, then it becomes real?
Yep. You know what the easiest way to deal with the climate change problem is? In scientific terms, it's the ultimate commons problem. I will emit CO2. I get the benefit of what I did with it, and someone else pays the cost. That's the ultimate commons problem. The best way to make it go away is make the commons problem go away. If we can develop renewable, cheap energy tomorrow, if we develop fusion in a glass tomorrow, it's not going to happen. But you see what I'm trying to say. If we develop the solution, then people don't have to accept climate change as an ideological challenge because they don't have to change their behavior. They don't have to change their beliefs. Problem solved, and it goes away. And if business is making money doing it, or if business is paying money to avoid it, then people will say, you know, do you believe those scientists? That's really, you know, do you believe their theories? Not sure. Hey, but this company is paying money because of climate change right now, whether it's ag or wineries or mining north of the Arctic Circle, then it must be true because they wouldn't throw money away needlessly.
This is 89.1 WEMU's First Friday Focus on the Environment. David Fair here. My co-host is Lisa Wozniak. She is the Executive Director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. Our guest today is Andy Hoffman, and Andy is Director of the Frederick A. and Barbara M. Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise. He holds appointments at the U of M Stephen M. Ross School of Business and the School of Natural Resources and the Environment, and he is also a board member of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters.
So how would you frame climate change within the current reality of the economic crisis? That is to say, how do you get people to connect climate change as a pressing matter when they can't pay their mortgage or they can't pay their student loans? And frankly, there's a big disgruntlement, if you will, with a large portion of our economic institutions right now in this country with the 99% movement. How does that all come together?
Yeah, this is the jobs versus the environment tension has been with us forever. You can go back to 1970 and the euphoria of the first Earth Day, and it got dissipated pretty quickly with the OPEC oil crisis. So that tension is always going to be there. If people are struggling to put food on the table, how can they be thinking about climate change? And you could even take that into the developing world. Why should a developing country care about climate change when they don't have safe drinking water and proper sanitation? This is a very difficult challenge. But addressing climate change, can it be reframed not as a negative, not as a sacrifice, but as a positive, as a more attractive vision of a future? That is, I think, something that environmentalists have not been very good at doing. Rather than scaring people by saying, if we don't change our ways, we're going to have this really unattractive future, if you say, hey, but if we take this lens, I can see a more attractive future. I can see an exciting future. Plug-in hybrids, connecting to the grid, new forms of transportation, new forms of mobility, rail. Governor Snyder has recently announced that he wants to see more rail. I go to Europe, I love riding on the trains. In this country, I dread riding on the trains. Mm-hmm. If you can frame addressing climate change as something desirable, as something that leads to a better future, you're going to get more people on board than saying you need to sacrifice and you need to compromise.
Why, with all of the talented and intellectual minds that are working these issues, have we not come up with a way to communicate that in an effective manner?
That's a really great question. There's a whole area of academic inquiry called risk and science communication. And we need to train people more to do that. I personally think that the reason the public debate has become so dumb is because the academics don't engage the debate as much as they should. If you look at the numbers of a number of surveys, scientists just aren't trained to do this. They aren't incented to do this. My tenure and promotion comes down to my academic publications, period, full stop. And we are not encouraged to enter the public debate. And let's face it, a lot of people don't want to do it, and because it's a nasty environment. I get climate skeptic hate mail. I have colleagues who have had death threats. Why would someone voluntarily do that, get involved in a debate where you're dealing with people that are going to reject you outright just because you're a scientist? What I like to say is right now we need another Carl Sagan.
I was just thinking that the difference between Stephen Hawking and Carl Sagan, both extraordinarily bright and intelligent, but Carl Sagan made it fun and friendly and easier to understand.
But the important point about Carl Sagan is that he was rejected by the scientific community as being anti-intellectual, as being a lightweight, as being a hack. He was denied
the Dr. Phil of the science world.
I guess, yeah. I mean, he was rejected admission to the National Academies of Sciences because he was seen as a popularizer. We have an academic bias against people who are popularizers, yet society needs that. They need it terribly. I heard a debate once recently. It was a discussion, David Brooks, and they were talking about Reinhold Niebuhr. And someone asked David Brooks, will anyone have the impact that Reinhold Niebuhr had? He was a theologian, social theorist in the middle of the century. And he said, look, this guy was on the cover of Time magazine. Find me a social scientist today that would end up on the cover of Time magazine. It's not going to happen. The line I love the most, he said, the milieu that created these great public intellectuals doesn't exist today. He says, I have many friends in academia, social scientists that I respect and really admire their work, but they're lost to the academy. And I love that line. They're lost to the academy. They are not engaging in the public debate. And the fact that they're not, I think, is part of the reason why we have this dumbed-down debate we have today.
So one of the books that you've published actually is a little primer, if you will, on how business and corporations should be looking at climate change and what are their business opportunities within that very fact, climate is changing. You've worked with companies all over the world, certainly numerous companies right here in Michigan. Have you seen any of them come through that process and want to lead in this in an active way? And are they? And are we just not seeing it?
Right now, what I see in the business community is companies are hanging back. You know, the U.S. Climate Action Partnership has downshifted. Until they see some serious movement in Washington, they're just hanging back because they really want to see, you know, some companies really want to see regulation because they don't like the uncertainty. If you have major capital asset decisions to make, and do we put in carbon controls or not? They don't know. But to that book, I mean, that book that I wrote, it was for Harvard Business Press, and it was, they said, take climate change and put it into business language. And that's a key here, is you need to translate. You need to be multilingual. And so we can talk about CO2 and carbon forcing and radiative forcing. People aren't going to get it. But if you can translate into business, let's talk about operational efficiency, consumer demand, things like that. To translate into the general public, again, on the idea of risk and science communication, we need to know how to translate. Scientists say the word uncertainty. They mean something about variability. The public hears they don't know. We need to really teach people how to translate things into multiple domains if you're going to get people to listen to it.
As we wind up our time today, where can I find the message and where can I find the messengers that will give me the information I need to make the most informed decisions?
Well, you know, you can go straight to the IPCC reports. You can start there. I am impressed when I do meet climate skeptics and they say, give me the evidence. And I say, well, go to the IPCC reports. And they say, what's the IPCC? And I struggle with that. The National Academies of Sciences, I mean, you're going to have to do some digging. There isn't, I don't think there's enough forward-facing, publicly accessible information out there. But the translation, I mean, if you're a Catholic, go take a look at what the Vatican's doing. They're doing some pretty interesting things. If you're an evangelical, go see what some of the evangelicals, there's a tension there, there's a fight there. If you're in the business community, there's plenty of business writing on this. Look for it translated for the audience that you want to speak to, and then you'll really get some traction.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and expertise.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That is Andy Hoffman. Andy is director of the Frederick A. and Barbara M. Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise, holding appointments at the University of Michigan's Stephen M. Ross School of Business and the School of Natural Resources and the Environment. He's also a board member of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. The executive director of that group, by the way, is Lisa Wozniak, who serves as my co-host for First Friday Focus on the Environment. Lisa, I'll look forward to our December visit.
I look forward to it as well, David. Thank you.
I am David Fair, and this is 89.1 WEMU.